Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In Tampa, the Republican argument against the president re-election was actually pretty simple, pretty snappy. It went something like this. We left him a total mess. He hadn't cleaned it up fast enough, so fire him and put us back in.
In Charlotte last night, it was Bill Clinton, attorney for the defense.
In Tampa a few days ago, we heard a lot of talk. All about how the president and the Democrats don't really believe in free enterprise and individual initiative. How we want everybody to be dependent on the government. How bad we are for the economy. This Republican narrative, its alternative universe, says that every one of us in this room who amounts to anything, we're all completely self-made.
A classic defense attorney's technique for the swing voters on the jury: frame the prosecution's argument as kind of absurd, and then set up your own. It's defense wrapped inside offense. Here's one more before we bring in Ben Smith from BuzzFeed. This is the president, the former president, responding to the central argument of the Republican convention.
Are we where we want to be today? No. Is the president satisfied? Of course not. But are we better off than we were when he took office? Man, listen to this. Listen to this. Everybody's forgotten. Everybody's forgotten. When President Barack Obama took office, the economy was in free fall. It had just shrunk 9.4% of GDP. We were losing 750,000 jobs a month. Are we doing better than that today? The answer is yes.
We will play more clips of President Clinton and Elizabeth Warren from last night, and we want your reactions, anything you want to say about Bill Clinton at the podium or Elizabeth Warren at the podium. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or of course have this conversation online at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show to post your comments. And joining us now from the Democratic Convention, Ben Smith, the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, formerly a political reporter with Politico and The Daily News. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Brian. Thanks so much for having me on.
So I guess it's too bad for the Democrats that there's that little thing called the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, which stops a former president from running for a third term, eh?
You know, yeah, there were definitely people last night saying that Bill Clinton would be in his sixth term. If not for that small detail, he was really just totally on fire, totally in command.
Like with Michelle Obama the night before, this was eye candy and ear candy for the Democratic faithful. How do you begin to gauge whether it made a difference for the president's reelection?
Well, I think the proof, I guess, will be in the polling in a couple of days. But there was a sense, certainly, that it wasn't just sort of emotional connection and ear candy. It was that he made this case, that he made this argument better than anybody else here had been able to make it, better than Obama had been able to make it. In part because the people who Obama and Romney are fighting over are Clinton Democrats, and some of Romney's most effective and visceral appeals to the white lower middle class voters who are likely going to decide the election have been saying, essentially, that Obama betrayed Clinton's legacy, and Clinton then rebutted that so forcefully last night.
In the Daily News today, they have an AP fact-check piece on the Clinton speech, and I want to play a few of the lines that they question on the level of fact. And here's the first one, having to do with cooperation and compromise.
When times are tough and people are frustrated and angry and hurting and uncertain, the politics of constant conflict may be good, but what is good politics does not necessarily work in the real world. What works in the real world is cooperation. Unfortunately, the faction that now dominates the Republican Party doesn't see it that way. They think government is always the enemy, they're always right, and compromise is weakness. One of the main reasons we ought to re-elect President Obama is that he is still committed to constructive cooperation.
All right. President Clinton from last night. That's the rhetoric. The Daily News and the Associated Press say the facts. Voters should have no idea that the inflexibility in both parties is to blame for much of the gridlock from Clinton's speech. Right from the beginning, Obama brought in as his first chief of staff Rahm Emanuel, a man known for getting his way, not for getting along. One of the more high-profile examples of a deal that fell apart was the outline of a proposed grand bargain budget agreement between Obama and House Speaker Boehner in 2011. The AP continues, the deal would have required compromise from both sides. Boehner couldn't sell the Tea Party faction on the plan, and Obama found himself accused of going too far by some Democratic leaders. The deal died before it even came up for a vote. So, Ben, I don't know if you want to comment on the clip or, for that matter, the fact check of the clip. I'm not sure that's the strongest indictment of that clip I've ever read.
You know, I have to say there's this rage for fact checking, and often it's great, and there's nothing I like better when reporters call politicians out for saying things that aren't true. But you know, to somebody who is a fact checker, like, you know, every problem, you got a hammer and every problem's a nail. That is not, these are not checkable facts. These are, you know, political arguments and differences of political opinion and, you know, in questions of blame that are, I think, probably better left to voters than fact checkers.
All right. Here's another Clinton clip that they fact check. This has to do with health care costs since the Obama health reform law was passed.
We Democrats, we think the country works better with a strong middle class, with real opportunities for poor folks to work their way into it, with a relentless focus on the future, with business and government actually working together to promote growth and broadly shared prosperity. You see, we believe that we're all in this together is a far better philosophy than you're on your own.
So that was a different Clinton clip. Here he is on health care costs since Obamacare.
For the last 2 years, health care costs have been under 4% in both years for the first time in 50 years.
But the AP says that's wishful thinking at best. The nation's total health care tab has been growing at historically low rates, but most experts attribute that to continued uncertainty over the economy, not to the Obama health care law. So, again, Ben, any thought on that?
I think what you're seeing are these big political arguments, and voters are, I think, these central questions of blame, of economics, are things that, you know, experts are disputing and the politicians are disputing, and that I think Bill Clinton made an incredibly compelling argument about.
And one more. Here is Clinton on the economy and the economic growth during his own presidency.
A lot of Americans are still angry and frustrated about this economy. If you look at the numbers, you know employment is growing, banks are beginning to lend again. In a lot of places, housing prices are even beginning to pick up. But too many people do not feel it yet. I had the same thing happen in 1994 and early 95. We could see that the policies were working, that the economy was growing, but most people didn't feel it yet. Thankfully, by 1996, the economy was roaring, everybody felt it, and we were halfway through the longest peacetime expansion in the history of the United States.
But according to the AP, the facts of that are that Clinton is counting on voters to recall the 1990s wistfully and to cast a vote for Obama in hopes of replacing those days in a second term. But Clinton leaves out the abrupt downward turn the economy took near the end of his own second term and the role his policy played in setting the stage for the historic financial meltdown of 2008. So some fact-checking of Bill Clinton there. Let's go to what, Ben, did you want to say something?
Those aren't facts. I mean, the idea that you correct a fact by saying here's something he didn't mention strikes me as a little odd. I do think the that was an extraordinary moment, though, because the there's been an internal debate for 2 years now in the inside Obamaland. Do you run making the case and encouraging voters that there's a recovery underway, or do you risk seeming incredibly out of touch if you do that? And they've been walking that line. They've been very cautious about it. And Clinton kind of just like grabbed that electric cable when he said that. When he said the recovery is underway, you may not feel it, but kind of look around you and you'll start to feel it. And if they can kind of convince people that there's a recovery, which is what Clinton did successfully in 96, what he's trying to do now, that would be an incredibly powerful thing and a new thing for Obama.
Listeners, what do you think? 212-433-WNYC. I know there were so many strong reactions to Bill Clinton. Now you get to say anything you want about his speech. 212-433-WNYC. Sally in Greenwich, you're on the air. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Great show, as always. My there's an ad running here in Connecticut. It's a Linda McMahon ad, and it accuses her opponent, Chris Murphy, of stripping or voting against or stealing $716 million from Medicare, which when I first saw the ad, I was confused. I thought, wait, I thought Chris Murphy was a Democrat. Why would he be doing that? And this is sort of a theme that President Clinton pointed out in his great comment about Paul Ryan last night, saying he had a lot of brass to talk about this $715 million, I hope it's not, where they're having a really effective campaign of confusing people about what exactly is going on with this Medicare. So I was grateful for the explanation from President Clinton last night, and I wish that more would be written and so that more people could understand this, because the Republicans are really having a field day with this.
Sally, thank you. And since you brought it up, we played this clip earlier in the show, but I'll replay it again on something that the Republicans have repeated over and over again at the Republican convention and elsewhere about the Democrats under the Obama law allegedly stealing $716 billion from Medicare to pay for other kinds of health programs. Here was President Clinton's rebuttal to that.
Now, when Congressman Ryan looked into that TV camera and attacked President Obama's Medicare savings as, quote, the biggest, coldest power play, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Because it takes some brass to attack a guy for doing what you did.
So that was part of it. Ben Smith from BuzzFeed. What did he mean there at the end by take some brass to attack a guy for doing what you did? What was he saying Paul Ryan did?
Well, Paul Ryan's budget includes in its baseline those same $716 billion in savings from eliminating the Medicare Advantage program. There's a debate over whether the Medicare Advantage program was a pure waste of money or something with some value, and when Republicans accuse Democrats of stealing, they're, you know, in a roundabout way saying this was a valuable program that got cut. But it's a very strange place for Republicans to be, basically arguing for more government spending on entitlements when the core of their actual argument are dramatic, dramatic cuts to those, when they rely on those cuts in, you know, balancing the budget or trying to.
Drew in Nyack, you're on WNYC. Hi, Drew.
Hello. My comment was that I've lived in several, lower class white areas such as North Carolina, Tennessee, and Cincinnati, Ohio. And from my experience, it seems that, you know, despite the Democrats' efforts to reach out to that communities, that a lot of these voters are still going to go with the Romney side just because of the stances on abortion, Medicare, and it just seems that the communities have become more polarized in the last couple months, and I'm really hoping that the Democrats find a different way to kind of communicate their efforts with the lower middle class there.
Drew, thank you very much. So, of course, a lot of people are locked in one way or another, but there is this 5 to 8%, whatever the number actually is, somewhere in there, according to the polls, that have yet to decide, and a lot of them, Ben Smith, are what you describe as white working class voters in the swing states, right? And that's exactly where Bill Clinton was aiming his speech.
Absolutely. I mean, he was aiming it at defanging, I mean, in particular, the arguments that that Romney is making most strongly to those voters, the Medicare argument, and an argument about and a claim that Obama has gutted welfare reform.
Luis in Closter, you're on WNYC. Hello, Luis.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Remember I called you last week and I told you I was completely undecided?
Yes, you called and said you were completely undecided. I do remember.
Okay. Yesterday night, Bill Clinton put the idea on my head to vote Democrat one more time. I love the way that he explained everything issue by issue. He did a better job than the Obama campaign was doing up to yesterday. Is there any law that prohibits him from taking over and direct the campaign?
Yes. Oh, well, to direct the campaign, I guess if they wanted to appoint him the campaign manager, they could do that. And I guess he will be on the stump, Ben Smith, for President Obama to some degree, making speeches. But the law that we referred to before, the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, prohibits him from running for president again.
I do think there is no law prohibiting him from just taking everything over, other than the presidency itself. And there are moments, I think, in internal conversations when the Obama people get the sense that he would probably be glad to. I do think he'll be out there stumping for Obama, particularly in the final days. I think some of those passages from last night's speech, or some version of them, will be all over television this coming week.
And probably and all over YouTube, because it's not just the – I didn't see the numbers. It was maybe 30 million, maybe not even. It was about 26 million for Michelle Obama the night before, out of maybe 126 million likely to cast votes in November. I don't know if you saw the television numbers yet, but there are also all these YouTube clips that will be made of some of the moments that we've been replaying, and that's a whole other distribution system today.
Although it's funny, you know, Bill Clinton is not a politician for the YouTube era, you know, for the moment of quick sound bites and kind of these clean, short, comprehensible clips. He's sort of, he's a jazz musician of politicians, and at his best, he's riffing for 5 or 10 minutes at least on a topic, And so I think, you know, that was something that hurt him and Hillary Clinton in 2008, he's a funny messenger for this media moment.
I see on your site, BuzzFeed, your two main questions about the speech, at least as of early this morning, were, did Bill Clinton just win the election for Barack Obama? And former Romney advisor Alex Castellanos says, lock the doors, Bill Clinton just won the election for Barack Obama.
Asked and answered, right?
Right. To which I say, everybody calm down. A convention speech by not the candidate cannot do that. Or, Ben, do you think can?
Oh, no. I mean, no single thing can do it, of course. And there was a bit of hyperbole there. But I do think there was a sense in the Republican convention that things never quite ignited. Obama, who's been leading in the polls the entire election, is looking for a bounce out of this convention, and I mean, I think what the Obama campaign hopes is they come out of tonight's speech up a few points in key states and never look back.
I want to play one clip of Elizabeth Warren, because as much as Clinton exceeded expectations last night, I think this rock star for Democrats, especially those concerned with inequality and the banks, she may have been a rock star in the hall, but I think she may have underperformed in terms of the general public. Her star was really supposed to rise last night. But here's a short soundbite of Elizabeth Warren.
Billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. And Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors, and acting like we should thank them. Does anyone here have a problem with that? Yeah, well, I do too.
So, not that that wasn't powerful, Ben, but I'm not sure that she connected emotionally. I'm not sure that she was able to start in low gear and build up to something like that. And by the way, I think Chris Christie had the same problem for the Republicans. And make that kind of connection, especially for the swing voters of Massachusetts, where she has to beat Scott Brown.
You know, the funny thing, the speaker she reminded me most was of Scott Walker, the Wisconsin governor, who's a very ideological figure, incredibly popular with Republicans. And he got out there and they said, you know, Scott Walker, ladies and gentlemen. And there was this massive applause that brought down the House. And that was the biggest applause line, his name. And Elizabeth Warren had some of that, too. When they brought her out, people just went nuts. And then nothing in her speech really lit people up like that. I mean, the best thing she has going for her, though, is that Scott Brown needs 400,000 people to check the box on ballots for Barack Obama and Scott Brown. in a state that's obviously going to go for Obama, and Elizabeth Warren just needs to cling to Obama's coattails.
So how does this whole night, especially the Bill Clinton speech, set up Barack Obama tonight? It seems to me that the guy famous for having a great speech will have a hard time matching either former President Clinton or his own wife, who may now give a better speech than he does.
You know, this is not a problem Barack Obama has traditionally had, you know, underperforming in formal speeches to large halls of people. I don't think anybody's too worried about that. And in fact, you know, Michelle gave this in some ways very traditional and relatively limited personal, narrow personal speech, although a very powerful one. And Bill Clinton had this very clear assignment to defend the past 4 years and to kind of embrace the Obama record. And what they've left wide open is for Barack Obama to talk about the next 4 years. And I think that's what he's expected to do.
For as good a speaker, as great a speaker as the president is, I think he comes off a little headier, less emotionally connected than either Bill Clinton or Michelle Obama. The risk is that swing voters may come away thinking, gee, I wish one of them was on the ticket.
I mean, if you look at the polling, I think, you know, Bill Clinton would blow either of these two guys away, as people remember him right now. I mean, I think he's one of the most popular political figures in America. And there is something to this idea that Obama is not great at connecting personally. If you're with him, if you've covered him, he's not the emoter in chief. People really like him, though. If you look at, you know, public polling, even people who are going to vote against him for sure tell pollsters that they like him, that they feel that he understands people like them, that he's kind of a real person. And so I actually think he's not. He has a lot less trouble connecting than people sometimes think.
Peter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I kind of agree with Clinton's comments about the private job growth and so forth as being a big factor. But one of the things that Elizabeth Warren brought up that has been, I think, underplayed so far is the change in the stock market since Obama took office, which affects everybody who has a 401k or a pension fund or anything else, and they can see the results reported in the papers almost every day as to what's been going on as an estimate of what's happening in the economy. And I don't know whether it's the volatility that prevents the politicians from paying more attention to it.
Peter, thank you. Well, the stock market affects some people's pocketbooks dramatically. Housing prices, other people's, just your ability to get a job or what your wages are, other people's, and they're all indicators that people are watching. In fact, Ben, one of the things for tomorrow morning that I guess we'll be talking about here and everybody will be talking about is the juxtaposition between President Obama's convention speech tonight and the monthly jobs report for August, which comes out 8:30 tomorrow morning. And it might be that, you know, the convention high get sobered up real quick.
Right. I think everybody is waiting very nervously for that. I think Goldman Sachs just put out a projection. They expect the numbers to be relatively low. Before Clinton's speech, I would have said, you know, everybody sort of realizes the economy is limping along and people aren't going to be surprised. Clinton saying what he said, that the economy is coming back, you're just starting to see the indicators, means people are going to be looking a little harder at those indicators.
Sam in Muncie, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Thank you for letting me talk.
Sure.
your guest, I think, pointed out something very valuable, and that is that this fact-checker business is not at all a fact-checker business. They're really political arguments, and so as a result of that, the newscasters and the news media are really becoming no different than the politicians. And they've lost their way in terms of being a check and a balance for the listener, like myself.
But why do you come to that conclusion, Sam? If these organizations like PolitiFact and FactCheck.org are setting themselves up specifically to debunk lies from the Democrats and the Republicans, lies or spin or half-truths or omissions, and they've got these gradations from partly false to pants on fire and, you know, all that stuff. Why say that they're just being like politicians?
Because the arguments that they're using, that they're saying are facts, are not really facts, they're opinions. They could talk about facts if they wish to. For example, when they said that the 4% reduction in medical costs they went and made a comment that these are not the lower increase in medical costs are really due to the fact of other reasons.
Yes, you're exactly right in that case. They weren't actually questioning the fact, and Ben Smith, we're going to run out of time in a minute, but Sam makes an interesting point. In that case, they weren't really questioning the fact that healthcare costs have been rising more slowly than in any time in the last 4 years, but they were questioning the suggestion that this is because of the Obama law rather than other forces that economists seem to agree on.
Yeah, I guess I just think journalists should do their best to get facts right and attack and should go after politicians when they get their facts wrong. But there are a lot of very complicated disputes that the kind of fact-check rubric is not the best thing to resolve.
Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, thank you very much for talking some Bill Clinton and Elizabeth Warren and convention stuff with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, the governor of Connecticut from the Democratic Convention, Dan Malloy. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now from the Democratic Convention, Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy. Hi, Governor. Thanks for taking some convention time to come on with us.
Hey, listen, it's great to be with you.
Let me begin with the essential challenge to Democrats for this week from the Republican convention. Are people in Connecticut better off today than they were 4 years ago?
Hell yes. People in America are better off. I mean, if you know, why don't you try to ask that question of Osama bin Laden right now? Why don't you try to ask folks who wanted to see wars ended and realize that this president brought closure to Iraq and is doing a drawdown as we speak in Afghanistan? Why don't you talk to 4,500,000 people who have gotten a job created under this president? Now, listen, I understand that if you didn't get one of those, things are going too slow. But this president has already created more private sector jobs in less than 4 years than George Bush did in 8 years. So, listen, Republicans want to tell people that we have not made progress. We've made progress. We're in a far better place than we were just a few years ago. Are we where we need to be? Absolutely not. But by not being where we need to be, should we go back to the same policies that drove the truck into the ditch in the first place? Absolutely not.
I was a little shocked recently to see one of the Electoral College maps from one of the news organizations, and Connecticut was in light blue, meaning that it leans Obama, but is in their estimation somewhat in play. And the reason was that a recent poll had Obama leading by under 10 points, 8 to be exact. Why would the polling find it to be that close in Connecticut?
You know, I don't know. There was another poll a few days later that had it at 13. So, you know, on any given day, things can change on polls. I don't know whether that was a one-day poll or a three-day poll. I don't know what their method was. Having said that, Barack Obama is going to win Connecticut, just like he's going to win New York and Massachusetts and Vermont and Maine and Rhode Island. And, you know, we're not going to be contested states. Now, where we are going to be contested is the state that I'm in right now, North Carolina, or elsewhere. We're going to see a hot contest in Virginia. So imagine North Carolina and Virginia being in play for a Democratic candidate. Things are changing. They're changing in our way. In fact, they're changing so rapidly for Democrats right now that in 19 states, Republicans have passed laws that would allow them to steal the election. And if that happens, we're in big trouble.
Do you think that a lot of the Connecticut finance sector workers who might have given Obama a shot in 2008 are now alienated by his Wall Street regulation, and maybe even seeing Elizabeth Warren get a primetime speaking slot turns them off even more?
You know, I don't know what does or doesn't turn off an individual. The reality is he saved the marketplace. I mean, you know, I'll put it in very stark terms. Romney wanted the automobile industry in the United States to go bankrupt. That would have taken the worst recession in anyone's lifetime and turned it into something rivaling the Great Depression. That's his fiscal policy. That's how he thinks. On top of which, he wants to take apart Medicare, Medicaid. He wants to raise interest on student loans. He wants to cut spending on education by 20% at the very same time that he's giving speeches about making education stronger in our country. He has a failed economic policy that is based on the idea that if you make the rich richer, somehow the poor will get richer too. It doesn't work. In fact, what happens in our country is when Democrats are in the White House, we grow the economy by growing the middle class. Failure to grow the middle class will stagnate for generations to come, our country. There's only one candidate who's interested in growing the middle class and providing the kinds of programs and funding and educational support that will allow that to happen. And that's Barack Obama. And he'll be talking here in short order.
And, of course, both candidates would say they're interested in growing the middle class. But do you think that Americans in many places do not get that about Obama? Just looking at, you know, the job you have, which is governor, there was kind of a Republican tide of gubernatorial elections in 2010. You were an exception to that trend, but a lot of state houses went from blue to red as apparently a backlash against Obama expressed at the state level. Do you think people don't understand how better off they are?
I don't think they understood what was in Obamacare. But I can tell you, when you're talking to people around my state and you say, hey, Mitt Romney gets elected, Obamacare goes away, you know that free or basically free insurance you have for your child between the ages of 21 and 26? It goes away. Now you have to buy a policy. If you're in the donut hole, 149,000 people in my state, the donut hole reappears and you don't have coverage for medical or drug coverage that was closed under Obamacare. I could go through that list item after item after item. The American people support Obamacare. What they didn't support was what Republicans were telling was in it. What they say was in it wasn't. It was a big lie. And all of a sudden, people are waking up and realizing that we will be a better democracy when every citizen has access to good health care, including our senior citizens. And these Republicans are so radical that they want to effectively end Medicaid, effectively end Medicare, effectively repeal Obamacare. What they really want to do is take us back to the 20s.
Let me ask you about, and my guest is Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy, let me ask you about the Romney Medicaid proposal. He wants to eliminate Medicaid as that, of course, is health insurance for the poor, as a federal entitlement for low-income people, and replace it with block grants to the states with lower funding than there would be under the existing program. Now, during the Republican convention,
That sounds like a tactic a certain governor in New Jersey used to balance his budget.
Well,
let's shift the obligation to local communities that is currently ours, and let's not fund the pensions, and we'll call that savings.
So, during the Republican convention, I asked former New Hampshire governor and Romney supporter John Sununu if that would make it harder as a governor to serve the poor and balance the budget, and I want you to listen to his answer.
If you're a governor with talent, you welcome that. It's the governors who are scared to death of having to make hard decisions that shy away from it. I would have loved to have to operate under that mode. I could then have delivered those services to my citizens in the most efficient way. I would have ended up giving more services for the amount of money we were spending.
Could you give me an example of how you could have done that more efficiently with less money?
Sure.
And still serve people better?
Sure. Medicaid now almost prescribes all the level of services you have to provide across the board, and what I have to do in a cold weather state like New Hampshire may be very, very different than a hot weather state like Florida. The kinds of treatments that we provide in a medical-rich service environment like New England may be different than the kind of treatments and services we provide in a more rural area like Arkansas. And for them to optimize the delivery of services like that requires flexibility that doesn't exist today.
Former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu from the Republican Convention, Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy with us from the Democratic Convention. Do you also think you could improve Medicaid with that flexibility?
Let me ask you a question first. When he was saying all that, were his lips moving? Because I know he wasn't telling the truth.
Yeah,
I mean, he didn't give you one specific example. Now, if he wants a race to the bottom, where a state like Arizona, would their legislature would vote to deny a kidney transplant in the case that it would save someone's life. If that's the kind of race to the bottom he wants to have nationally, and apparently is, that's how you save money. You actually deny treatment. Now, this, by the way, from the guy who was the original architect of privatizing Social Security. That government is doing these programs more efficiently than the private market in some cases is doing them drives them crazy. And the idea that their friends aren't making money on this drives them crazy. He's dead wrong. And by the way, the people who will be dead are the people who we're currently caring for.
One other gubernatorial issue on this whole business of welfare work waivers. Are you one of the governors asking for a waiver?
I think a waiver, yeah. I don't want to kick people out of training programs near the end of their training because there's some arbitrary line that's been drawn in the sand. I think if somebody's in a program, completing the program, complying with the program, we want the ability to make sure that they actually get the degree in that program. So, yeah, we are one of those states.
So that's the nature of the waiver request, that so people can stay in training programs?
So that we can continue to have people in training programs through completion dates that may not necessarily jar with termination rate.
I read that the national average is only 29% of welfare recipients working at any given time because states can qualify for aid using various items in a formula as it stands. Do you know Connecticut's number, or what's your experience working with that as a governor?
Well, actually, Connecticut has one of the shortest periods of time in which benefits can be claimed already. And we are a state that actually is confronting the fact that as we get better training programs, people cannot complete the programs within the time required.
Last thing, we had Chris Murphy on from the convention earlier in the week, the Democratic candidate for Joe Lieberman's Senate seat as Lieberman retires. The polls show Linda McMahon is doing better against Murphy so far than she did against Senator Blumenthal, who beat her 2 years ago. Do you think the dynamics of this race are different?
Yes. She's spent another $20 million on top of the first $50 million, and she's going to spend another $30 million. And so if you care about a Congress, a Senate, that represents the president's point of view, then you better do something in your life to make sure Chris Murphy wins. And if you haven't written out a check, send him one.
Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We recorded that interview with Governor Malloy yesterday at the Democratic Convention. And as we did during the Republican Convention, we'll get a satirist's eye view next of the festivities, including the Bill Clinton speech, from Baratunde Thurston. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and last week, WNYC's special jaundiced eye correspondent at the conventions, Baratunde Thurston, gave us the lowdown on the Republicans. Now it's the Democrats' turn, unfortunately for them. Baratunde, who's a former politics editor at The Onion and author of the book How to Be Black, joins me once again from Radio Row, this time in Charlotte. Hey, Baratunde.
Good morning, Brian Lehrer. Good to be back. I have a view of a hot dog stand, extreme loaded dogs.
What is it? Nathan's, Needick's, what is it?
It's Nathan's and a bunch of other stuff crammed into a little cylindrical shell that tastes delicious and is probably horrible for your insides.
All right, let's go to last night. The Clinton speech, the most anticipated speech other than President Obama's. What did you think?
I thought Bill, as I like to call him, we're first name buddies, brought it home. He went over his time limit, as many predicted, by at least 20 minutes. But he has that prerogative because he did a great job. He's a former president, and he worked the crowd. He taught a bit of a lesson. He sort of took everybody to school. He was a blend of Ross Perot without the charts, Glenn Beck without the crazy, and did what he called sort of the jobs score repeatedly throughout the night, doing a bit of arithmetic and math to remind us of where we've come from and what we've got left to do.
You're on a first-name basis with him. What does he call you, Barry?
No one calls me Barry, Brian. No one.
You know, the Republicans say if Obama's mother had named him Barry instead of Barack, then he wouldn't have had this special aura to him. He'd never been elected president. So it's a good thing in your case, too.
I definitely have benefited from the uniqueness of my name. And actually, it's funny, when you mention names, you actually remind me of the fact that Bill Clinton mentioned Barack Obama probably more in his speech last night than the Republicans mentioned Mitt Romney in their entire convention last week. And that was a significant point of difference between these two gatherings.
It's a great point. It's really, really true. I want to play a clip that you asked us to pull as one of your favorite moments from last night. So we will listen to this when President Clinton takes direct aim at Congressman Paul Ryan.
So President Obama and the Democrats didn't weaken Medicare. They strengthened Medicare. Now, when Congressman Ryan looked into that TV camera and attacked President Obama's Medicare savings as, quote, the biggest, coldest power play, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Because that $716 billion is exactly to the dollar the same amount of Medicare savings that he has in his own budget. You got to get one thing. It takes some brass to attack a guy for doing what you did.
Now, Baratunde Thurston, we can't repeat on the air what you tweeted about that moment. But suffice it to say, you feel that Paul Ryan was knocked down a few notches?
I think it's sad that he had to be. I think, you know, the reaction to the Romney's campaign statement that they're not going to let themselves be dictated to by fact checkers is a superficially fun and deeply horrifying statement to make in the midst of a presidential campaign or any other time. And so, you know, my take on it and the feeling of the room was that you just had this grown-up, this Bill Clinton figure in this moment, take Paul Ryan out to the backyard, rub his nose in poo, and smack him with a newspaper. It's just like bad boy. And it was really a leveling up of maturity to watch Clinton explain this thing that we really shouldn't even have to be explaining, but for the fact that Paul Ryan was so comfortable being dishonest.
And you leveled up your language to poo from the original version.
I did.
Economic issues aside for the moment, social issues have played a significant role in these conventions too, and I want to play another clip that you requested from the president of Planned Parenthood, the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Cecile Richards, that touches on the health insurance issue for women.
Because of President Obama, soon women won't be denied insurance coverage because we've had breast cancer or survived sexual assault. And we're no longer going to pay more than men for the exact same health insurance. Thanks to President Obama, being a woman is no longer a pre-existing condition in America.
Nothing funny about that clip. Why did you want us to play it?
Because that phrase, being a woman is no longer a pre-existing condition, it was, again, it's sort of a sad phrase that it has to be repeated so much, but it's also one of those lines that people know sounds good, and so they use it over and over and just sort of kill it. If you were playing a drinking game triggered by that phrase, you would have blacked out before the end of last night because almost every speaker hit you over the head with that pre-existing condition as a female sort of comparison.
So we're going into the last day of the DNC. You spent a lot of time roving around these two conventions. What would you say were some of the major differences?
There are more people, it feels like, in Charlotte than in Tampa. The pending hurricane may have something to do with that. My cab conversations in Tampa revealed that a lot of people just left town because they didn't want to be bothered and have their routines ripped up by the visiting people. Charlotte seems to have more heavily embraced it. There's a street festival. It has a more of an actual carnival feel to it. There are guys selling T-shirts on the streets and really cool buttons that say things like, once you vote black, you'll never go back, which is obviously not true. But it's a fun thing to put on a button. And, you know, I'd spend a buck or two for something like that. There is a festive and more positive environment to this DNC gathering. The Republicans definitely had energy, but it was more negatively directed. It wasn't as pro-Romney as it was let's get Obama out. And a lot of the vibe here, you know, centered around reelecting the president and trying to remind people of where he came from and where the country has come in the past 4 years, sort of reverberates throughout this more festive music sort of concert atmosphere. The GOP was more business.
So that's all well and good, but I want to hear more about that other difference you pointed out, less khakis.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, as many of your listeners may recall, last week I exercised my rights to count. I wanted to see how many black people there were at the Republican convention. I dubbed this Negro spotting via Twitter hashtag, and I reached 238, by the way. I don't know if I ever reported my final number to this show. There are 238 black people spotted at the RNC, the vast majority of which were servicemen and women from the military, law enforcement, vendors, and professional media. I estimated about 60 actual GOP folks. I tried that here in Charlotte, and game was over within about 2 hours. I happened upon a mother load of black people. They're just everywhere. There's too many black people at the DNC to count. And so I had to wrap that exercise up almost after I landed. There's a lot going on here.
Another way of saying less khakis at the Democratic convention.
Yeah, definitely. Less khakis, more black people.
Last week you and I had some fun doing what you call a hash out. And I gather you want to do that again. So hit me with this.
Yeah, so the question we're asking everyone today is, after the convention, what does President Obama have to do to win re-election?
You're asking me.
I'm asking you, Brian.
All right.
I'm going to flip this around.
Here's what they need to do to get Obama re-elected. And bear with me because it's a little complicated. So
complicated?
I wrote, yes.
Uh-oh.
Barack and Joe Biden both need to resign, but not at the same time, because then John Boehner would become president and then they're toast. But Obama resigns today, right now, this afternoon. Biden becomes president, but he directs the convention to nominate Michelle Obama to be the new nominee. She's a better campaigner than Barack is anyway, and she gives a better speech. Then she picks Hillary Clinton as her running mate, and she and her husband, what's his name, who spoke last night, they campaign around the country every day. Michelle will be elected. Then Hillary resigns as vice president. Michelle appoints Barack. Then Michelle resigns, and Barack Obama is once again president of the United States. It's complicated, but I think it's their best shot.
So it's you lost me at resign, and it sounds like you got this bit of a shell game going on. I guarantee that's the most complex answer we're going to get to that question. I certainly hope so, and I hope it doesn't come to that, Brian, but thank you.
It all makes total sense. Just watch the tape, which is where... Where again?
We're going to be at news.yahoo.com/hashout. Everybody, feel free to weigh in on that question today after the convention. What do you think Barack Obama needs to do to win re-election? If you're doing this on Twitter, you don't have time to make such a complicated answer as Brian just shared with America. And hopefully no one's thinking on exactly the same lines as you. Very creative, though. You win from most creative interpretation.
I'll work on getting that down to 140 characters.
Good luck, man.
You're doing this other hash out, I hear, where you're asking people what are the 5 words that they want in the Obama speech tonight. What are some examples of the responses you're getting on that?
Well, so there are people who are talking about some more obvious words they want to hear, like jobs and economy, strong. There are a lot of folks who, you know, kind of want the president to take ownership of his administration and its successes and be aggressive and just declare, I will win in November. Yes, we can again, things like that. And then, of course, there are people who are not excited about the presidency of Barack Obama and said, you know, I want him to say, I will resign effective immediately. I nominate Paul Ryan to be my VP and other such unlikely scenarios. But it's a free country.
It's a free country. Speaking of which, itsafreecountry.org is our politics website, and that's where you're posting some of your stuff from the convention?
Absolutely. Lots of photos, lots of observations. I found myself in the bowels of the convention center, the arena, earlier this week. I found the speech writing room where words are made. I found cages where they keep volunteers. I stumbled upon a group of heavily armed men who I think I wasn't supposed to run into, so I let the elevator door slide close quietly and awkwardly at that moment.
So you can see that Baratunde material and even a picture of he himself if you've only heard him on the radio at our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. He also has his book, How to Be Black. Baratunde, enjoy your last day in Charlotte.
I will, and thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Don't forget our 7 o'clock convention night call-in tonight. We'll take your calls and those from listeners in the swing states who are part of our mostly swing state radio network. And then at 8 o'clock tonight, our convention coverage continues, hosted by Amy Eddings, right through President Obama's speech. Hope to talk to you again tonight at 7 for the beginning of our final convention night coverage.